From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Senator Arlen Specter, the incumbent Republican from Pennsylvania, is being challenged by political newcomer Lynn Yackel, who said she entered the race because his questioning of Anita Hill made her angry. Also, we talk with Linda McCartney about her new collection of photographs from the 60s. Most of the photos are of musicians, including Paul McCartney, who became her husband. And rock historian Ed Ward remembers the 1966 riot on Sunset Strip and the music that came out of it. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. A second attempt to schedule the year's first presidential debate failed today after the Bush campaign once again refused to agree to its format, NPR's Andy Bowers reports.
The bipartisan commission charged with setting up this year's debates set a deadline of noon today for both campaigns to accept the terms for a meeting next week in Louisville, Kentucky. The Clinton team had already agreed to the single moderator debate format proposed by the commission, but the Bush campaign continues to insist on having a panel of journalists asking the questions. The same impasse led to the cancellation of a debate last night in Michigan, although Governor Clinton showed up anyway and instead held a televised town meeting. Both campaigns insist they still want debates, but so far there's no sign that either is willing to back down from its position. In the meantime, the commission will keep scheduling debates, hoping that both sides will eventually show up. I'm Andy Bowers in Washington.
Supporters of Ross Perot are trying to determine whether there's enough backing for the Texas businessman to resume his independent bid for the presidency. In several TV appearances during the past week, Perot has said that he made a mistake in abandoning his presidential bid in July. Orson Swindle, the national coordinator for a Perot volunteer group, said he's asked the state offices whether they want Perot to run. Workers at Perot headquarters prepared to install a larger system for the phone bank, and Perot is reported to have TV and radio ads in readiness. China's foreign minister has criticized governments that sell large amounts of weapons and military equipment to other countries. The comments were an apparent response to Washington's recent decision to sell 150 F-16 fighters to Taiwan. NPR's Jim Zeroli reports.
In an address to the United Nations General Assembly today, Foreign Minister Qian Qichen implied that the sale of advanced weapons to Taiwan by the U.S. was a gross interference in China's internal affairs. He said it violated a 1982 agreement on arms sales between China and the U.S. Qian also responded to Washington's criticism of China's recent decision to sell nuclear technology to Iran. He spoke here through an interpreter.
We oppose the attempt of a country to interfere in and obstruct the normal cooperation between sovereign states under the pretext of preventing arms proliferation.
Qian said international arms proliferation should be carried out in a fair and reasonable manner and should not preclude the legitimate security needs of individual countries. In New York, this is Jim Zeroli reporting.
Stock prices showed little change today as investors balanced the uncertain currency situation in Europe with a Federal Reserve report that showed modest growth in the United States. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 2 points to close at 3,278.7. Declines led advances by a slight margin in heavy trading. This is NPR News. The latest Federal Reserve survey indicates that business conditions are slowly improving, but the recovery is uneven. The so-called Beige Book report is a summary of statistics from various sectors of the economy in the Federal Reserve's 12 districts. The latest report found weakening conditions in California and much of the Midwest. At the same time, economic activity generally picked up in the Plains states and the East. The report noted that the recovery was uneven from one sector of the economy to another. There was more turbulence in the currency markets today. The French franc came under attack from traders. NPR's John Idstey reports.
Currency traders apparently believe the French currency is overvalued and have been selling francs. But the French and German central banks issued a joint statement today saying the existing exchange rates between the franc and the German Deutschmark, the strongest currency in Europe's exchange rate mechanism, is justified. The statement indicates the two central banks oppose devaluing the franc. The banks have backed up their conviction by intervening in the currency markets, buying francs and adjusting interest rates. The Bank of France raised its key interest rate by 2.5%. The European Community's system of managing currency values calls for the relationship between currencies to remain stable. European officials want to avoid a replay of last week's currency chaos, which caused the British pound and Italian lira to drop so sharply their governments had to pull them out of the system. I'm John Idstey in Washington.
Federal health officials are reminding people that now is the best time to get vaccinated against potential epidemics of influenza. The Centers for Disease Control said that there's no way to predict how bad the flu season will be in any given year. Last year, the flu season began in October and reached epidemic levels for about 7 weeks from December to February. The CDC said that flu and flu-related pneumonias kill about 10,000 Americans every year. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. One of the most closely watched Senate races this year is in Pennsylvania, where the incumbent Republican, Arlen Specter, is being challenged by Democrat Lynn Yackel. My guest is Senator Specter. Ms. Yackel joined us earlier this month. The race is being watched in part because of what it might reveal about women's issues in politics. Senator Specter is being challenged by a woman at a time when there are few women in the Senate. But Specter is widely acknowledged as having a strong record on women's issues and has voted pro-choice. The Pennsylvania branch of the National Abortion Rights Action League, in an unusual move, endorsed both candidates. Another issue in this race is the lingering impact of the Clarence Thomas Anita Hill hearing on voters. Specter, a former district attorney in Philadelphia, was on the Senate Judiciary Committee and was the Republicans' chief questioner of Anita Hill. Senator Specter recently expressed disappointment in Justice Thomas's performance so far. I asked why Specter was disappointed in Thomas.
I said that some of his decisions were somewhat disappointing, such as the one where he did not find cruel and barbarous treatment where a prisoner with manacles was beaten. But I also said, and it wasn't covered in the wire reports, that 1 year is really too soon to make any finite judgment. And I thought back to William O. Douglas, who was the greatest civil libertarian perhaps in the history of the Supreme Court, who in his first year or two supported electronic surveillance. So I think that we have to wait and see, really, on Justice Thomas.
Do you have any regrets that you supported him?
I do not, because I think it is indispensable in America to have an African-American on the court. I think it was a national scandal that it took until Thurgood Marshall in 1967 to have the first African-American, and for that matter, really just wrong to wait until 1981 to have Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. And when you see the problems in Los Angeles and problems that I used to see as District Attorney of Philadelphia, where I made it a point to have many African-Americans on my staff as assistant DAs or as district attorney detectives, in fact, had the first African-American chief of DA detectives, I think it's just indispensable. And really, it's not a question of whether Justice Thomas is the best nominee. I publicly disagreed with the president when he said he was the best person. I said that I didn't think so and named others, like Bill Coleman. And I also disagreed with the president when he said that race was not a factor. I think race was a factor and a very, very appropriate factor. But had Justice Thomas not been confirmed, the reports were that the person behind him was not African-American and even more conservative.
Your opponent, Lynn Yackel, has said that one of the reasons why she decided to enter the Senate race was her anger at how you questioned Anita Hill. I'm wondering if you think your role in the Clarence Thomas hearings and your method of questioning Anita Hill has affected your support in your reelection bid.
I don't think my opponent said that it was one of the reasons she entered the race. I think she said it was the reason she entered the race. That has been her single issue from the start right down until the present time. When others had chance to speak to the issues, when Congresswoman Boxer, for example, or former Mayor Feinstein or Ms. Braun from Illinois spoke at the Democratic National Convention, they talked about the problems facing their states and the nation. When my opponent spoke, all she talked was about the single issue. Do I think it's been a problem in the campaign? Yes, I do, but I think it has receded very materially. as I have worked hard to get my message out, that whatever anybody may think of my questioning of Professor Hill, no one can deny that there is not one of the other 99 senators who has a better record on women's issues than I do. I've been pro-choice. I've supported federal funding for women. I've been a leader, along with Senator Harkin, to bring additional funding for breast cancer. I've been, along with Senator Biden, a co-sponsor of his on the legislation to protect women against violence. When I was district attorney, I had special units on rape and sexual assault, so that I think that that problem is receding, but it's still there to an extent.
Well, you point out your strong record in supporting women's issues and in supporting the right to abortion. When Clarence Thomas was chosen as the nominee for Supreme Court Justice, I think everyone in the country had a sense that one of the reasons why he was chosen was because he was likely to vote against abortion, even though he didn't come out and give his stand on abortion during the hearings. But it was widely felt that that's how he would vote. And I'm wondering if that troubled you at all, as someone who has supported the right to choose over the years.
Well, I do not think you can select a Supreme Court nominee based on a single issue. And that's just not my personal view. That's really the attitude of the whole Senate. And let me tell you why it's really demonstrable. If you take Senator Barbara Mikulski from Maryland, no one could doubt her credentials on choice. She voted for Justice Anthony Kennedy, who was widely believed to be anti-choice or pro-life. Anthony Kennedy was confirmed 99-0. When Scalia was up, everybody knew he was pro-life. That was plain. And he was confirmed 99-0. Ted Kennedy and Paul Simon and Howard Metzenbaum all voted for them. So we just do not pick nominees based upon a single issue. That's just not the American way.
Many people felt that your line of questioning of Anita Hill wasn't designed to reveal the truth, but rather it was designed to discredit Anita Hill. What's your response to that?
My response is that the New York Times said my questioning was painstakingly polite. Nina Totenberg, your distinguished commentator on National Public Radio, one of the people who broke the story, said my questioning was entirely professional. Let me say this by way of addition. I don't really think that it serves a useful purpose to rehash the hearings. What I have found for myself personally is that it's been quite a learning experience. I had been district attorney of Philadelphia and had had some substantial experience with sexual harassment, but I didn't know how widespread it was until really after those hearings, and it sort of came into sharp focus when a friend of mine, a woman in her late 40s, early 50s, said to me that she had been sexually harassed. And she said to me, "Arlen, when you were questioning Professor Hill, I almost felt as if you didn't believe me, and it was very painful for me," she said. And I told her very spontaneously that it made me feel bad to hear that I certainly had not intended to cause her any anguish or pain, and that what I was trying to do was to find out what happened between one man and one woman in one specific circumstance. And I do think now, and frankly thought then, that we went too fast. On Sunday afternoon, when we got together to decide whether we would observe the one-week limit that the full Senate had instructed us to do, to come back so they could vote again on Tuesday, in the closed session, I disagreed, and then I disagreed on national television. I said I thought we should take longer. Listen, there were 14 men and one woman. It wasn't a good visual. 14 white men and one African-American woman, and when there were other women who wanted to come forward to give us their views, I thought we should have taken more time and said so. We were really trying to figure out why she moved with him from the Department of Education to EEOC, why she called him, why she drove him to the airport, had social contacts, and other people wanted to testify about how a woman in her position might respond. But it has been quite a learning experience, and I think that although painful, in many ways America has benefited. I think that workplace conduct has changed, and a lot of people are a lot more sensitive about that issue today than they were a year ago.
You were saying that you were trying to understand why Anita Hill would keep up
contact with Clarence Thomas if he, in fact, had said the things that she had accused him of saying. Now, Clarence Thomas was already a very influential man who could have helped or hurt Anita Hill professionally. As a politician yourself, as someone whose career depends on political expediency and cutting deals and forging alliances with people you don't necessarily like personally, why was that so hard to understand?
Well, I do not agree with your statement that I operate on political expediency or cut deals.
Well, I wasn't accusing you personally. I mean, I just think all politicians have to operate by certain political rules of the game.
Let me say this. I think there's a lot more to the Senate race than Professor Hill and Justice Thomas. And I have commented on it extensively, but my preference, and I've tried to do this with my opponent in this political race without much success, is to talk about the economy, putting 10 million Americans back to work, or talk about affordable health care for all Americans, or education reform, crime control, environmental protection. I think those are the real issues that face Pennsylvania and America. And when we spend all the time on Professor Hill, I'm glad to talk about it, and I already have extensively, but I'd like to talk about some of the real issues facing my state and the country.
Let me get back to the question, though. As someone who understands the way politics works and that it's not necessarily, friendship or good feelings towards someone that help you forge an alliance or make a political deal together, why was it so hard to understand why Anita Hill would keep up professional contact with Clarence Thomas?
When I took into account everything that Professor Hill had said, and I tried to do it very fairly and very objectively, I just felt that on the weight of the evidence, it supported Justice Thomas. And I think the American people came to the same conclusion as reflected in the public opinion polls.
What do you think were the reasons that you were chosen to be the chief questioner of Hill during the hearings?
I think I was asked to take on that role because I have such a strong record on women's issues, because I had led the fight against Judge Bork. I opposed Judge Bork because I thought he was the most extreme nominee ever to have been submitted for the court, and the people who didn't like my conclusion on Justice Thomas were delighted with it on Judge Bork, and I think that it was thought by those who asked me to take on the questioning that my record with women and my ability as a questioner and my prior record in being very independent from the administration gave me good credentials for the job.
Did you discuss your role with anyone in the administration?
I did not discuss my role with anybody in the Bush administration.
You've called your questioning of Anita Hill legally correct but politically unwise. Would you have done it differently if you could do it again today?
Oh, I think with what I've learned that the sensitivities would be more profound and there would be some changes. But let me just say this. We're over half of the time on this interview, and you ask the questions and I give the answers, and I know that you're privileged to play all this. But when we have problems of the economy and health care and environmental protection and crime control and foreign policy, those are some of the things which I think ought to be discussed on a program for the Senate race in 1992 without spending more than half of the time on one hearing. Whatever anybody may think of my questioning of that hearing, there is no doubt that my record on women's issues is very, very strong. No one in the Senate, among the other 99 senators, has a better record. And there are a lot of other issues.
You accused Anita Hill of perjury during the hearings. Do you stand by that?
The record in the congressional record is detailed on the reasons that I set forth then, and that's what I have to say about the subject.
My guest is Senator Arlen Specter, who is running for re-election in Pennsylvania. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Senator Arlen Specter is my guest. And let's talk about the economy. I wonder if you support either the president's or Governor Clinton's economic proposals to turn around the economy. Or if you have a different vision of your own that you would put forward.
The economic proposals that I have favored were taken on the common points from what the president sent to the Congress and what the Congress sent back to the president. When the president made his State of the Union speech and sent over a 7-point proposal, it got very short shrift in the Congress. And then the Congress sent back its own economic recovery program, Congress controlled by the Democrats, and candidly, it got equally short shrift in the White House. Senator Domenici and I took a look at both programs and found that there were 4 points in common. And many months ago, in April, we introduced legislation to urge that we act on those 4 points, an investment tax credit for first-time home buyers to give young people a chance to buy houses and to stimulate the building industry, an investment tax allowance to stimulate manufacturing, bringing back passive losses on real estate to separate out genuine real estate transactions from tax shams, and a fourth, to have broader rules for investment of pensions. And we've tried very hard to get that adopted since it was in both proposals, and I'm still trying to do that. I advocated one other idea last November when I took a look at the budget deal and found that the government cannot spend any money to prime the pump, so to speak, and noted that there was $800 billion fund from IRAs, individual retirement accounts and related accounts, and came forward with a proposal to utilize that money by having middle-income Americans be able to withdraw up to $10,000 without penalty or tax for use on big-ticket items like homes, college, medical expenses, or a new car. And it was estimated that that would put some $40 billion into the economy by Chairman Greenspan. But I think the government can do quite a lot to stimulate the economy. I think we should have acted before now. And as we speak, we're taking up a tax bill on the Senate floor, which could stimulate the economy better late than never.
You started off your political career as a Democrat and switched to the Republican Party, and I believe it was 1965 when you couldn't run as a Democrat for district attorney in Philadelphia. You've become one of the Republicans who most often votes against the president. Are you comfortable as a Republican?
I am comfortable as a Republican. I did run on the Republican ticket when I was a registered Democrat in Philadelphia in 1965. We had a very corrupt city administration. The Attorney General of the United States the year before had said that in Philadelphia nearly half the people were on the take. The chairman of the Democratic City Committee paid me a compliment. They were his words that they didn't want a young Tom Dewey in the DA's office. So I accepted the Republican nomination, did not change my registration, stayed a registered Democrat, and was the first person elected on the Republican ticket in many, many years. And then changed my registration because I wanted to try to bring back a two-party system in Philadelphia. A two-party system is great in our country, but it only works if there are two parties. And am I comfortable as a Republican? Yes, I am. I'm comfortable in the mold of Senator Javits as he outlines the Republican philosophy in his autobiography of a public man. Comfortable with many of my colleagues, Bill Cohn, Jack Danforth, Jim Jeffords, John Chafee. There's a need for moderate Republicans in the party, and I feel comfortable here.
What have some of your greatest frustrations been in the Senate since 1980 in trying to fight for things that your state, Pennsylvania, needs? And Pennsylvania is one of the states that was hard hit by the move from an industrial base to what's been described as a service economy. But a Pennsylvania state that's really suffered during the period of industrial decline.
I have been most frustrated by being unable to get the president and the Congress to agree on a compromise economic recovery package this year when there were 4 points in common, which I referred to before from the president's package and the congressional package. And I took that directly to the president, directly to the Senate majority leader, and I couldn't bring the parties together. That's very frustrating, because I think if we'd passed that package in the spring, we'd be on our way to an economic recovery now. I'm very frustrated by not being able to bring health care to the floor. As I specified before, I tried to bring it to the floor through an amendment in July and was stymied by the majority leader. When you talk about Pennsylvania, I feel pretty good about what we've been able to do there. We've kept the Navy Yard open, won an historic case where I argued it personally in court for the Philadelphia Navy Yard. We have brought considerable funding to Western Pennsylvania for high-tech, the Department of Defense Software Center. We have a great new airport out there. We've gotten money to update the locks and dams. I've been in every one of Pennsylvania's 67 counties, and through my seniority and place on the Appropriations Committee have brought a lot of federal help to Pennsylvania.
Did you go to the Republican convention?
Absolutely.
And what were your impressions of it?
Well, I was sorry that we were unable to muster the six states to challenge the platform on abortion. I don't think that abortion has any place in a political platform, just like I don't think government should control abortion. I was not pleased with Pat Buchanan's speech. I didn't like the points that Reverend Robertson made, but there were other aspects that were good. I think Governor Weld of Massachusetts spoke well in articulating a stand in favor of right to choose, in favor of choice. I thought that Mary Fisher, who was a victim of AIDS, spoke eloquently about the need for the party to assist people who are afflicted with AIDS. Yeah, the convention had a lot of good and bad in it, sort of like the Democratic convention when they wouldn't let Governor Casey speak on his own views, even though he's the governor of a big state.
Senator, you've made it very clear to me during this interview that you feel you shouldn't be asked a lot about the Clarence Thomas hearings during the course of the interview, and I'd like to know really why not, for this reason. The American public got to see more of you during those hearings than perhaps they saw of you at any other time, because they were nationally televised and because it became such a national event. And most people felt very strongly about your performance one way or another. Why at re-election time isn't it a good time to really hear from you why you did what you did?
Oh, I'm delighted to talk about the Justice Thomas hearings, and I have spent considerable time. But it sounds like the repertoire of my opponent. There's just a lot more to this race than a single issue. We haven't had a chance to talk about education, break the mold schools. We haven't had a chance to talk about the tremendous problems facing the environment. We haven't had a chance to talk about the foreign policy with the Soviet Union or the important issues of the Mideast. And when the campaign comes back again and again and again to the single issue, as I speak to America on national public radio, I just think there's a lot more that faces this country.
Arlen Specter is a Republican senator from Pennsylvania who is running for re-election. His opponent, Lynn Yackel, joined us earlier this month. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
Linda McCartney made her reputation as a photographer in the 60s, taking pictures of emerging rock musicians, many of whom later became superstars. Coming up, we talk with McCartney about her new collection of photos from the 60s. The book includes pictures of the Beatles from the period when she met Paul McCartney, who became her husband. Also, rock historian Ed Ward remembers the music of the 1966 riot on Sunset Strip. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Bush campaigned in North Carolina and Pennsylvania today in two important electoral states critical to his reelection plans. Mr. Bush presented a repackaged list of benefits and incentives for small businesses and defended his veto of family and medical leave legislation. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
President Bush told small business owners today they were the backbone of the economy, and he proposed a half dozen incentives and tax breaks aimed at rewarding the, quote, risk takers. The five-year $20 billion initiative would reduce corporate tax rates, simplify tax laws, and make it easier for small businesses to acquire capital. Mr. Bush twice defended his veto of family leave legislation, which he said would cripple small businesses.
I believe in family leave. And I believe our approach to facilitating family leave through tax credits is a far better way than putting new mandates on a guy who's struggling to make ends meet and would have to lay off people to meet the costs of that program.
Opponents counter that the legislation sent to the White House exempted businesses with 50 employees or less. The legislation has twice been rejected by the Bush administration. I'm Elizabeth Arnold reporting.
Democrats Bill Clinton and Al Gore have been campaigning today in Georgia, talking about military defense and criticizing President Bush's veto of a family leave bill. Gore accused Mr. Bush of casting his veto in the dead of the night when he hoped no one would notice, adding there's no way you can say that you're for family values and not be for family leave. Mr. Bush vetoed the bill late last night. In Washington, the current round of Middle Eastern peace talks is drawing to a close, with no breakthroughs, but there was a glimmer of hope for future talks and comments by Syria's foreign minister. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
The Syrian foreign minister, Farouk al-Sharaa, said today Syria is willing to give Israel, quote, total peace in return for total Israeli withdrawal from occupied Arab lands. Sharaa was in New York for the UN General Assembly meeting. The Syrians have been reluctant to say they'd give Israel a full peace treaty, holding out the prospect of a more limited, less solid agreement. So al-Sharaa's comment today caught the attention of Israel's chief negotiator in the Israeli-Syrian talks. Itamar Rabinovich said, "My curiosity has certainly been aroused by the word total, particularly when applied to the word peace." But he cautioned against putting too much weight on a couple of words. Meanwhile, in New York, an American official left a meeting with the Syrian foreign minister saying, "We've heard something interesting, and we will convey it to the Israelis." The official did not elaborate. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down more than 2 points to close at 3,278.69 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. For the second time in 2 weeks, a bipartisan commission has had to cancel a proposed presidential debate after the Bush camp declined to take part. The Commission on Presidential Debates says that Bush campaign officials declined to meet to talk about arrangements for a debate next week in Louisville with Democratic challenger Bill Clinton. Mr. Bush, campaigning in Pennsylvania today, said he thinks there will be debates. The commission has recommended a single moderator for a Bush-Clinton meeting, but the Bush camp wants several people on a panel. In South Africa, the government and the African National Congress are still struggling to set a date for a summit meeting that would restart talks on the country's political future. Top negotiators from both sides will meet again tomorrow. NPR's Ann Cooper reports.
For the past several days, ANC and government leaders have raised hopes that a summit could be called as early as this weekend to bring together President F.W. de Klerk and ANC leader Nelson Mandela for a debate on curbing political violence. Such a high-level meeting could also revive stalled negotiations on a transition to democratic elections and majority rule in South Africa. But a summit announcement that was expected today never materialized. Instead, the government said negotiators for both sides would continue meeting in an attempt to resolve pre-summit issues. The hang-up is believed to be a disagreement on ANC insistence that the government must free political prisoners before Mandela is willing to meet de Klerk. I'm Ann Cooper in Johannesburg.
At the UN, members of the UN Security Council are pushing a new war crimes resolution in connection with attacks on civilians in former Yugoslavia. As a result of ethnic fighting in the area, more than 1 million people have been forced out of their homes to account for the worst refugee crisis in Europe since World War II. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Now she's best known as the wife of Paul McCartney. But before Linda McCartney met the famous Beatle, she was an up-and-coming photographer in demand for her pictures of rock musicians. She was the first house photographer at the Fillmore East and had pictures in the first issue of Rolling Stone. She photographed Jimi Hendrix, The Doors, and The Grateful Dead before they became famous. Now she's collected some of her pictures in her new book, Linda McCartney's 60s, Portrait of an Era. After years of taking pictures of bands, she ended up in one. She's been singing and playing keyboards in her husband's bands since the 70s. Linda McCartney spoke with Fresh Air producer Amy Sallet.
Your first gig as a rock photographer was at a Rolling Stones promo event, which was in 1966, and they were on a yacht in the Hudson River, and you ended up being the only photographer allowed on the boat. How did that happen?
They had invited so many photographers and so many journalists that they realized they couldn't get them all on the boat. So somebody came up to me and said, "You will be the only photographer." I went, "What?" And they said, "Yes, we can't get them all on, so you come on." And I went on and was a photographer.
So what did you see when you were there? Was there some kind of attitude or personality of the band, or was there some kind of irony in the event? Like, what was it that you saw that you really wanted to capture?
Well, I was too nervous to think what I wanted to capture. I was just hoping the pictures would turn out. No, I actually just wanted to capture the different personalities, and I must say, everyone seemed to enjoy being photographed by me, and they each had their own personality. Like Charlie Watts, I found very quiet and dignified sitting at the back of the boat. You don't call it the back of the boat, but anyway. And Mick was more of a ham, and Brian Jones had his own personality. But really, I was just trying to get good pictures.
Why do you say you think they enjoyed being photographed by you?
Probably, I think a lot of musicians were used to being photographed by press photographers who had flash and, okay, stand here and go there and, you know, that kind of thing, and impersonal. Whereas I didn't have flash, and I was, I suppose, being a girl helped too.
You weren't really a trained photographer, and you'd never done that kind of thing before, right?
Right, I'm still not a trained photographer.
Well, after that event, were you really bit by the bug? Like, did you feel like, this is what I'm going to do now?
Well, before that event, I loved photography. I mean, Walker Evans and Dorothea Lange and Cartier-Bresson photographed so beautifully life that I thought, well, I'm going to be a photographer anyway, but I never thought I'd make a career of it, that it would pay my rent. So after that event, a few of the journalists I'd sold the pictures to liked my photographs so much that they started ringing me up and saying, well, look, we are writing about so-and-so, and would you come and take the pictures? So, of course, it was great for me. However, I had a 9-to-5 job at the same time, so I had to quit my job and become a photographer.
Did you figure out a way of working with the person that got the best picture?
Well, I think it was a lot to do with chemistry. I mean, if I was taking, let's say, photographs of Tim Buckley, who was, a lot of people haven't heard of him, but he was a beautiful songwriter and guitar player. I think just walking around Central Park and almost we were pretending we were in the country and just talking and asking him about himself and that kind of thing brings out a relaxed personality in people. I think friendships help bring out the real person rather than this is my job, I need a picture, go stand over there. I think it was quite warm. to walk around and just talk about things.
So would you suggest, say if you had an assignment to get pictures of a person, would you suggest to them that you just go and hang out with them for a while instead of just meeting them at a place and snapping their pictures? Is that what you would do?
Well, I didn't have a studio. I didn't have an assistant. I didn't have an agent. So it wasn't a question of going to a, you know, a place where I set up lights or anything, because I always use natural light. And no, I could meet anywhere. I used to meet people either at their manager's place or whatever, their hotel, whatever. And then we just, wherever we were, we just start walking around and taking pictures. And also, you know, if you're just hanging out in jeans and stuff, it's not too stiff. And it's really easy fun. And then you just take pictures through it all.
So do you snap a lot? Were you constantly, would you take a lot?
No, actually, I'm not one of those people who takes a whole roll and then hopes for one good picture. I try to take less than, you know, less is more. I try to take one or two or three pictures of each situation.
Because Paul writes in an introduction to your book that you know just the moment to click.
Uh-huh. No, I do, actually. It's all to do with feel and looking, and you know, most of us don't look at things. We're so busy being distracted. I actually like looking, and therefore I can feel when to click.
In your book, there's a quote you say, "I would rather photograph a wrinkled apple than a made-up, smooth, glamorous man." Can you tell us more what you meant by that?
Well, I think character of people is so important, and I think glamour smooths out the character. I mean, Georgie O'Keeffe, the painter, is a favorite of mine. I would have liked to have taken pictures of her just because she has such an interesting face. You know, and some of the poets like Auden, that kind of thing. I like the wrinkles. I like the thought and the life behind the faces rather than covering up everything. I don't like the veneer so much as the substance.
Can you describe one of the photos where you feel you really caught the character of the person?
I think most of them I caught the character. Certainly Jimi Hendrix I did, and Janis Joplin. I like them all, quite honestly. I like one of the Beatles around the Sgt. Pepper time, because I think it shows John and Paul on a really happy note and an exciting note together, and a humorous, almost their tongue-in-cheek humor in that one.
I'm speaking with Linda McCartney, who you may know as the wife of Paul McCartney. She's also worked for many years as a photographer, and she has a new book out called Linda McCartney's 60s, Portrait of an Era. More after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Linda McCartney is my guest, and her new book is a collection of photographs she took of rock musicians in the late 60s. Since your last name is Eastman, or was Eastman, and you were a photographer, a rumor got started that you were an heir to the Eastman Kodak fortune. But I just found this out recently, that your father's name had been Epstein, and he changed it to Eastman.
That's right. So no relation, you see.
Now, why did he change his name?
I think the German war had something to do with it, really. You know, I think he just wanted to. Probably didn't like the name that much.
Are you Jewish?
Absolutely.
Uh-huh.
But I don't believe in religion, so I'm born Jewish, but I don't practice it. I don't practice any religion.
Your father was a successful entertainment lawyer with several famous clients. What was it like around your house when you were growing up?
Well, he had a lot of good musicians over to his house as well, like Hoagy Carmichael and Harold Arlen and Tommy Dorsey. It was good fun, but I wasn't that into it because I was more into horses and daydreaming, so I didn't get that involved with it, really.
So you didn't feel it was like Uncle Hoagy?
Oh, no way. No, I used to sit up. It was around the time they'd invented television, so I used to sneak upstairs and watch television all the time. No, I didn't like going down into it, actually. I was pretty much a loner then.
How did you first find out about the Beatles? Did you watch them on the Ed Sullivan Show?
I did indeed. In fact, I ordered their first album. I lived in Arizona at the time, and I heard the music and really liked it. And I saw them on the Ed Sullivan Show.
Now, you and Paul did get together, and what's it like to have a courtship with a Beatle? He was so famous by the time you got together.
What was it like? It was, I think, like any romance, if it works out well. You know, we were building a relationship. We weren't together for the press or for the media, so it was real, that's all.
But he can't, I mean, you can't just go out in public very easily, and there were a lot of pressures on him, probably.
Yeah, there were a lot of pressures on him, but I took all the pressures off him. Oh, no, we went out in public, funnily enough, because I lived in New York at the time, and we hung out a lot in New York and used to take subways and go up to Harlem and go everywhere, and people didn't really notice. I think it's when you announce you're coming or you're doing a show or something that you get a lot of hysteria, but, you know, we can be just regular people when we're just on our own.
How long had the two of you been going out when he asked you to marry him?
I don't remember, a few months.
What was it like for you to go from being a voyeur, someone who photographs other people, to having the lens turned on you?
I like being a voyeur a lot better. I'm still a voyeur, by the way. Look out.
Do you take a lot of pictures now?
Oh, absolutely. As many as I took them. I just don't get paid for it now. You know, it's not a living, but if I had to make a living as a photographer, I would, but I became a photographer really for the love of it, not as a career.
Back when you first became Mrs. McCartney, do you think the fact that you were a photographer affected how you dealt with all these photographers who were after you? Were you nicer to them, or did it help you figure out how to get rid of them or how to control the situation?
Well, not really, because I'm the type of photographer who wouldn't take a picture of anybody who didn't want me to. In fact, I went up to Bob Dylan once after a show at a dinner we were at, and I said, "Do you mind if I take a picture of you?" And he said, "I'd rather you didn't." So I didn't, and I always felt very shy about ever taking a picture of him. So I think I'm a different type of photographer than the paparazzi or those kind of photographers, and I think you just tolerate them, really, as most things.
Right. You got together with Paul right around the time the Beatles were breaking up, and that must have been a really traumatic time for him. Did that put a strain on your relationship?
Oh, of course. I mean, it was a heartbreaking time for him. You know, I think he would have liked it to have gone on forever because they made good music together. So I think I was a shoulder to lean on or cry on, as they say.
Did it interfere at all with your relationship? Or?
Oh, I mean, of course it interfered in the point that there was a lot of stress and a lot of misunderstandings going on. But, you know, you can't change things. That's the way it was.
Your father became Paul's business manager, your father and your brother. Weren't you nervous about that? Isn't it dangerous to mix romance and business, and especially when such huge sums of money are at stake?
Well, I knew they were very good, so I thought the mess everyone was in over there, I thought he was quite lucky to get them, quite honestly. But, yeah, it's funny, mixing business and pleasure. I'm not that keen on it, yet here I am in the band. And, you know, but that's life, isn't it? But I think they helped a lot. They helped sort things out. I mean, they were very tough times.
I read that you wanted to raise your kids in a very normal way, and that even though you were really wealthy, all of you lived in a little two-bedroom bungalow. How did you decide what's normal, and what kinds of things did you do to make your family life normal?
Well, I must say we're pretty earthy. The little bungalow is a nice little place, by the way. Wealth doesn't make happiness, and to live rich sort of gets you away from the realities of life. And I think we wanted to be normal and are normal just because that's warm. You know, it's much friendlier to be close. If you live in a big house, you're all in different rooms and you never see each other. I grew up in Scarsdale, which was very nouveau riche and wealthy. And everyone I knew's parents were getting divorced, the kids were miserable, and money doesn't buy happiness. So I was for being real and being close to our kids rather than have chauffeurs and spoil them, really.
You've been part of Paul's bands ever since the Beatles broke up, and you didn't really have a musical background
No.
Before that.
Didn't have a photography background either.
Right. Now, but you've really taken a lot of heat about being in his bands. Was it something you really wanted to do?
I think it was something I said. No, yes, we wanted to be together, and I've always loved music, so it's been a lot of fun. It's getting more fun. We've just finished a new album, and that's really great, so.
What's the band called? Is this Wings?
Still? It's called The Act.
When will the album be out?
In the beginning of the new year.
Who's in the band?
We did a show on MTV called Unplugged, and it's the same band that we played with then. There's six people. They're all really good musicians, unlike me, so you're all right there.
You still feel you're not a good musician?
Well, I mean, I can play. I'm not a great musician, but I don't want to be a great musician. You know, I'm doing so many things. You can't be good at everything. But I love it, and I fit in, and they don't seem to mind me. They quite like playing with me, so it's all right.
Linda McCartney has a new collection of photos called Linda McCartney's 60s. She spoke with Fresh Air producer Amy Sallet. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Terry. Today we're discussing debates of the presidential variety, whether or not there are going to be debates. And if there are debates, then what happens with Ross Perot if he comes back in? Alan Tomlinson is filing a piece from Florida on the effects of Hurricane Andrew on the ecology of the region. Both candidates are out talking about business people. Computer company heads are coming out for Clinton, and Bush is talking about what he plans to do for business. And we have a piece from Michigan on the teacher strike in Detroit.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. America has a long history of riots, and they've nearly always been motivated by racial, political, or economic tensions. But for 2 weeks, in the middle of 1966, the riots on Sunset Strip in Los Angeles pitted the police against middle-class white youth who just wanted to hang out and be left alone. The riots left their mark on the day's popular music.
Just doesn't seem fair to bug you 'cause you got long hair. Even the parents are beginning to scare because of the siren.
LA riots, happening in the entertainment capital of America as they do, have always managed to have musical touchstones. The Watts riot, for instance, gave birth to Watts Stacks, a giant concert that was made into a movie. And this year's riot was presaged by so many angry rap records that nobody who pays attention to popular music could have been surprised when the city that gave us NWA and Ice-T went up in flames. But before them, there was the riot on Sunset Strip. This wasn't quite the spontaneous uprising that the other two were, and in fact, it seems to have been instigated by the police, who couldn't have picked a worse location to go after the unruly kids they were so afraid of.
There's a man who leads a life of danger. To everyone he meets, he stays a stranger. With every move he makes, another chance he takes. Odds are he won't live to see tomorrow. Secret agent man, secret agent man. They've given you a number and taken away your name.
The Whiskey a Go-Go at Sunset in San Vicente was the central focus. In 1966, when the riots hit, it had only been open less than 2 years, with Johnny Rivers and his band as the main attraction for most of that time. But owner Elmer Valentine watched the street, and he knew that it was time for more modern music. Soon, he'd raid the London Fog Club next door for the band that was packing them in over there, the Doors. The other big hangout was Pandora's Box at Sunset and Crescent Heights. Pandora's had been a beatnik joint in the 50s, and later the Beach Boys had had an engagement there, But in 66, the house band was led by a sometime Phil Spector sideman and former rockabilly singer from Oklahoma, Leon Russell.
Drop the golden sunset drip and the golden sunset children skiffle along the path that's called the strip and they're looking for a bird to flip and a hole to hide from the tourist eyes are watching. Tourist cars come into town and the black policeman's cards are down inspecting all the players round the places where the joker's found and waiting for his chance to be the dealer.
Underneath Pandora is the city's first underground newspaper, the L.A. Free Press, held forth, which gave it a unique perspective on the goings-on out front. The problem was, kids liked to hang out, but not many places would let them hang out. There was Ben Frank's, an all-night eatery that would serve kids, and there were the clubs, if you had money. But it was just as much fun to walk down the strip, rubbernecking at the hip clothing shops with the latest from Carnaby Street. And you'd meet other kids from all over L.A. who were just like you, and it was groovy. It was also illegal. A curfew was passed because some of the tonier merchants were concerned about shoplifting and the crowds who milled around on Sunset Strip at night, crowds of oddly dressed kids on who knows what kind of drugs. Things got ugly.
There's something happening here. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
There was no single flashpoint. One night, kids who felt that the cops were hassling them about the curfew just said no. Violence ensued. At one point, the cops drew a line in front of Pandora's and dared the kids to cross it. This sort of thing continued for a couple of weeks, and finally, the cops prevailed. From then on, LA's underground rock scene was marked by paranoia, an us-versus-them mentality that was evident not only in the songs bands like The Mothers of Invention wrote, but in films like Easy Rider and, of course, Riot on Sunset Strip.
Ed Ward writes for the Austin Chronicle.
Come gather round, people, wherever you roam. Admit that the waters around you have grown. Accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone. For the times, they are a-changing.
Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Sue Spolin and Sue Weinstein. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. And we welcome our new intern, Kezia Perlman. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional grants are provided by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Gary Sinise about directing and starring in a new film adaptation of John Steinbeck's Of Mice and Men. And we talk with Walter Kern about his new novel. It's about a right-to-life activist and a woman seeking an abortion who meet outside an abortion clinic. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.